You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 325 of the Columbia Calling podcast. It's been a topsy-turvy couple of weeks. Of course, we've been up and down emotionally as well of this lockdown that's been going on for, well, more than 2 months here in Bogota and around the country. Even this last week, Mayor of Bogota, Claudia Lopez, was on my street hanging out at the side of a Hilux van with a motorcade of no less than 15 vehicles as she yelled into a megaphone about how we needed to stay at home and how my barrio, or at least alongside it, is now in alerta naranja, so an increased risk of the virus being caught in this area. Never very positive when you're here with young children and so on. But we struggle on and we do what we do. And we keep bringing you the Columbia Calling podcast week in, week out. And last week's show, 324, was very well received. You remember that we were talking to Canadian journalist Nadia Drost. And of course, that was part one of the three-part series about the Darien Gap crossing. And it was pretty harrowing, to say the least. Of course, our interviews and conversations with her are based upon an article she wrote, and that also has been recorded for a PBS documentary that will come out on the Darien Gap and migrants crossing and going up to the US. But the article came out in California Sunday Magazine in April, so you can just look it up there. Fantastic article, great photographs by Carlos Villalon, who is a friend to the Columbia Calling podcast as well. And we're just going to go straight back into and further conversation this week with Nadia Drost. We'll be talking about the economics of the migrants going through the Darien Gap, and indeed hearing some, well, pretty terrible stories, but also we've tried to finish on something a little bit more upbeat. So we have some stories coming out of the Darien Gap from Nadia Drost today. She'll be talking about more of the experiences, as she will be on 326 next week as well. And we'll wind the Darien segment down for the Columbia Calling podcast. But I know you've enjoyed this. And this week there will be no Columbia Reports update from Adrian Alsema there in Medellin, because he's working very hard to put out information for expats or foreigners or travelers stuck in Colombia who need help. We're a big community and we're all here to help one another. And I know if you check out www.columbiareports.com, you're going to find a community of people willing to help you out here. It's a time where we all need to look out for one another. So good news there from Adrian's work in Medellin. So we will take a short break and be straight back and dive right into our conversation once again with Nadia Drost. So don't go away. This is a great, great episode. Thank you again. Bye-bye. This is episode 325 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I'm here with Nadia Drost, who's on the line from Toronto, Canada, and we're going to delve a little bit deeper into her experiences traveling alongside migrants heading from parts unknown across the world: Syria, Sri Lanka, Haiti, Bangladesh, Cameroon, Angola, and the list goes on. And we're going to talk a bit further into the economics of crossing the Darien Gap and some more of her reflections and information and, of course, a warts and all story of what goes on when you get into the Darien jungle, you know, handed over by, let's say, bandits or smugglers or guides, as they call themselves, and then onto the Panamanian side. And what are all the intricacies of the crossing? So we're going to leave it, basically, in the hands of Nadia again this week and hear what she has to say about this perilous crossing. Thank you.
their journey, you know, physically the most challenging part was crossing the Darien Gap for them. But once they got to southern Mexico, they all of a sudden were so surprised that, you know, they had already come so far across so many borders, and they just had one more border to cross until they reached their destination. But getting out of southern Mexico was actually the most challenging part of their trip, because by the time they arrived, I mean, when I met up with them, we're talking October. And since the summer, Trump had, you know, he had announced his complete asylum ban on the southern border. And that meant that, you know, Mexico was basically taking every measure possible to prevent migrants from moving from southern Mexico up to the border with the United States. And that meant there were thousands of National Guard manning checkpoints. They had roadblocks. Detention centers were bursting at the seams. There was no way that legally migrants could leave southern Mexico. I mean, they were literally trapped. And it's really painful to see this slow realization dawn on them that sometimes happens, you know, over weeks when they're trying to gather information, they don't speak the language, they're going off, you know, what's happening to their friends who are in detention or released from detention. And they come to this realization that the only way to leave southern Mexico is either by applying for asylum in Mexico and, you know, committing to living your life in Mexico, or hiring a smuggler to help them get to the U.S. border, which, you know, of course, for many of them, they had no money left at this point. Imagine a family traveling with several kids. I mean, you can't, it's to gather the money to be able to hire a smuggler for an entire family. I mean, the costs are astronomical. So that part of the trip, you know, they were coming up against essentially Trump's border wall, but already in southern Mexico. And that was a whole new set of political and bureaucratic challenges that they came across. So when you put all of these experiences together, the journey that they make is absolutely epic.
It truly is. It truly is almost terrifying to think, leaving Bangladesh and all that you go through, perhaps through that region of the world, and then over to Brazil. And when you, I mean, there's so much to talk about, but, Firstly, quickly, the PBS documentaries are available to see.
So the Mexico story did come out in the fall. Mm-hmm. The two pieces that are going to be about the crossing of the Darien Gap have not aired yet, and because of coronavirus, are kind of shelved for the moment. But we do hope that they will be broadcast in the next month or two. Okay. At the latest. Viewers can, you know, look on the PBS NewsHour site, Google Darien Gap, hopefully in, you know, a month or two, and we'll be able to see those two stories there. Okay.
Fantastic. We will share them, definitely. And what there's something that comes up in all of this talk is the financial aspect, of course. And winding way back, I'm thinking of all of the costs. I mean, this is a phenomenally expensive, not just, I mean, journalists, of course, but for these migrants, phenomenally expensive. Did some of them tell you how much they'd spent so far? I'm just curious how much, for example, as a guide to get you through the Darien Gap, a guy who's going to get you through, not going to rob you, not going to leave you there. And then in Panama, you've got to get up to, you know, Costa Rica, to Nicaragua, and then presumably through Honduras, and then you're in southern Mexico, and the prices go on increasing, and then you're stuck. And then, you know, you've done this, and you're in southern Mexico with them, and this is a lot in what I'm saying now, and you're going to have to unwrap it. In your article, you say, because you said you were there by about October, in your article you say the line goes dead in December to many of the people who you have had contact with and got to know on the journey. So tell us a little bit about this, the financial side, and then what's happened to so many of these people that you got to know who've been traveling with this trauma and have been so financially burdened. I struggle to get my head around it. It's so, this is, as you say, epic.
Yeah, no, it does feel larger than life. Sure, with the finances, it was very variant upon, a few factors. Some of it had to do with, where they were actually flying from. We noticed that it seemed like, trips from Asia were more expensive than trips from Africa, or obviously these Haitians who were coming from Brazil or Chile. And then a lot of it had to do with how they were traveling. So a lot of migrants don't end up hiring a lot of smugglers on the way, or hire them for very short parts of the journey, like the Darien Gap, or to cross certain borders in Central America. And they don't tend to be that expensive. To give you an idea about the Darien Gap, most prices that we heard of migrants who had arrived in Capurganá and were just hiring a guide like on the spot, it was usually around like $50 per person. And then there were some extra costs. So, maybe if they wanted to be taken one day farther, another $10 per person, or if they wanted a smuggler to carry a bag for them for a day, that would be another $10. Maybe it could be $30, depending on the weight of the bag. But so for an individual migrant, it doesn't tend to be that much. If you're traveling with a family, that can really add up, even though there are discounts for, the smugglers don't tend to charge for children. That price doesn't include the whole crossing.
Yeah.
That price is just usually for the first two or maybe 3 days of the trip. Sometimes, if you get a really crappy, shady smuggler, I met people who had been abandoned by their smuggler after 3 hours.
Ugh.
And, got lost for days, ended up circling back to where they had started after a few days, already consuming all of their food. Anyway, but to go back to the finance question, so there are these hard costs on the journey that include these kind of shorter smuggling stints, as well as just the cost of traveling, right? Overland buses, food along the way, hotels. But that's if you kind of do the trip on the fly, so you figure things out as you go along. That's where WhatsApp is. It's a real key aspect of this migration journey. The smartphone is everything for these migrants, and WhatsApp has kind of like set alight this digital migration pathway, because most migrants, the way that they know how to do this journey is because others have gone ahead of them, and they share in WhatsApp messages, they share tips, they say, this is how you cross the border, into Guatemala. Here's a phone number or a name or a photo of a guy who can help you across the border. Ask for Jorge. it can be as general as that. So those are kind of some of the costs associated with doing the trip step by step.
Yeah.
Then there are a lot of migrants who do it in a kind of more organized fashion. And they refer to people that they call agents along the way who assist them. And the involvement of the agent starts in the country of origin. So let's say you're coming from Bangladesh. You hire an agent already in Bangladesh. Sometimes the agent is like a travel consultant, is like a real travel agent. In Cameroon and Nigeria, for example, there's travel agencies that advertise in their windows. They have signs that say visa-free countries. And you can walk in there and just ask, where can I buy a plane ticket to where I don't need a visa?
Wow.
And for, many years now, Brazil and Ecuador have been, two of the easier countries to enter without a visa. Since late summer, there are regulations from Ecuador and Brazil that have changed. So they've added some restrictions. So now, for example, to enter Ecuador, you do need a visa, but it's still relatively easy to get a visa. But it really helps if you have somebody called an agent who can arrange for you to have an invitation letter or a hotel reservation, something that shows that, you have enough money to support yourself during your stay in Ecuador, that kind of thing. Mm. And so basically there is this kind of chain, this chain link of agents along the way who, if you buy a package tour, let's call it, from Southeast Asia, that package tour will include your plane ticket and it will include assistance with paperwork for any visas that are necessary. And it will also include tips along the way. Sometimes it'll include transportation or smuggling trips, but based on what I heard, most often not. And so basically it means that, when you arrive in a destination, you can consult with this agent, okay, where do I go from here? And they advise you on which hotel to stay in, what mode of transportation to get to your next destination, what your next destination should be, which town should you go to. But rarely do these agents appear, physically, and rarely do they show their faces. I had not heard of stories where, physically they appeared. But I have, from other people who track this migration route, I have heard that sometimes, they might appear in a town and kind of corral people into a van or onto a boat. So there is definitely assistance along the way, and that's something that migrants have to pay for. Mm. I found that most of the migrants who come from Southeast Asia, a lot of them, that's how they do the journey. They pay a very large sum of money, anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 is what I most commonly heard. And that includes these tips from agents. But, it doesn't include bus tickets or hotel nights necessarily. So yeah. those are costs that really, really, escalate. And definitely, one of the problems that you have after the Darien Gap crossing is so many people got robbed. Yeah. Many of them got robbed of, essentially they're their life savings. A lot of the Africans and Haitians, they don't have families who can wire the money necessarily. They're carrying, a a few thousand dollars that is all that they have to bring them to the American border. And when that's stolen, I mean, that's actually really it for them. In the magazine piece, I briefly mention a really tragic story of an Angolan father who was traveling with his wife and three children. And his trip, he called it a cauchemar, a nightmare. His family had been robbed of everything on the trail, their entire life savings. And then several days before they reached their destination, they were crossing a river and he lost grip of his 9-year-old daughter, who was swept away by the river and she drowned. When he arrived in Panama, he was an absolutely broken man. And he was trying to get beyond this tragedy and think pragmatically of how he was going to physically keep going with his family. And he said to me, he said, my family is from Angola. We are a poor family. I cannot telephone them and ask them to send me money. They don't have it. And there is a real difference in migrants. There are some migrants who can ask their families for money, and others or friends sometimes, and others who can't. And in Panama, the problem is that there's no Western Union in the whole Darien region. You have to wait until you get to Panama City. But many of these people, they don't have the money to buy the bus ticket to bring them across Panama. And so there's this whole business that goes on inside the Panama camp where basically locals offer to go to Panama City, receive a wire transfer on behalf of the migrants, and deliver it to the migrants. There's no accountability in this. And of course, these middlemen, they charge a huge cut, anywhere from 10 to 25%. So the money is a real issue. And I think that when Panamanian authorities hear that, there's bandits who are robbing migrants in the Darien, it's not the kind of robbery that a lot of these families can recover from. It's kind of like it can absolutely devastate their entire journey. Oof.
Just shocking. And the story of the Angolan resonated so much with me as a parent, of course. And it just,
of course,
I couldn't even possibly get, even imagine that and the grief that he must have been experiencing, which kind of leads me on. Have you had contact with any of these migrants since?
Oh, yeah. That was the part of the question I'd forgotten to,
that's okay,
to answer. So I have. I managed to keep in touch with some of the Haitians and pretty much all of the Cameroonians up until, I would say, some point in November or December. A lot of, I would characterize, their time in Mexico, almost everybody either was, some of the Haitians were trying to apply for asylum in Mexico or permanent residence. Almost anybody who tried to leave on a smuggling trip to the U.S. border was caught at some point by Mexican authorities and tossed into detention. And then usually released after a few weeks. A lot of the migrants, and I'm talking mostly about the Cameroonians, were the ones who I had the most regular contact with. They kept in very close touch. If they were tossed into detention, they would call me as soon as they got out. But that's why when, all signals kind of went dark by December, I reached the conclusion that that probably meant that they were in detention again in Mexico or in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But then when the months dragged on and, you know, I hadn't heard from them still in February, my conclusion was they've got to be in U.S. detention because they didn't tend to spend more than a few weeks in Mexico if they were in detention. One of them contacted me from a Texas detention facility. Her name is Sandra. She's featured in the magazine piece. And she was since transferred to Louisiana, where she remains in an ICE detention facility. And her situation is very difficult. And it's also really difficult to kind of comprehend because she actually has a fiance, a Cameroonian man who traveled before her to the U.S.
He's in Huntsville.
He's in Huntsville, Texas. Yeah. He's there legally. He has work authorization and he actually works as a prison guard at a maximum security prison. And he got Sandra a lawyer. And they applied for Sandra to have parole so that she could keep on applying, you know, not to be deported from the U.S. She did not pass her credible fear interview, which is where an asylum officer in the U.S. determines whether her fear is justified in returning to Cameroon, in which case she might be able to continue into asylum proceedings. It's known that asylum officers are basically instructed these days to turn down every single applicant, and it's nearly impossible to pass a credible fear interview, and you really have to kind of learn what the exact answers are that they want to hear. And so she cannot apply for asylum. The vast majority of people crossing the U.S. border now are not eligible for asylum, but they can apply for a far lesser protection that basically prevents them from getting deported, but doesn't give them a path to citizenship. It doesn't give them any social security benefits, but it does allow them work authorization and the ability to stay in the United States for a temporary amount of time. I believe that they have to renew every single year. So it's a very unstable position, but it's, you know, seen as better than obviously being deported to somewhere like Cameroon, where, you know, conflict continues to rage. And so Sandra was denied parole. She was denied the opportunity to go to her fiance's house and continue her immigration proceedings from his house, which was really shocking for me to hear because, she actually had a house to go to. She had somebody who was able to support her. But these parole decisions are really arbitrary. And, immigration lawyers have told me that even if communities and churches and NGOs get together and sign letters of support, it often doesn't do anything to sway the judge's decision. So Sandra is still in a detention facility in Louisiana. The last time I spoke to her, which was about 10 days ago, she had started to not feel well. Her facility hadn't reported any cases of corona yet, but nearby detention facilities in Louisiana have had outbreaks. So that's obviously something that's very top of mind for them. And I have happier news for a lot of the other characters who appeared in the piece. So just in the last 2 weeks, a lot of them have kind of been trickling out of the U.S. detention system and have been getting in touch. Several of the Cameroonians are out on parole. And for anybody who's read the magazine piece, Pastor, who... Yeah. is nicknamed so because he's very religious. Uh-huh. He spent several months in detention in Texas, and he's now reunited with family members in Maryland, and he's doing really, really well. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said he was released on parole. He actually is the only one who I've heard of so far whose application for asylum was accepted, which is kind of miraculous. And the reason is because he had applied for it in Mexico and was rejected. And that meant that he was able to apply for it in the U.S. So in the U.S. now, you're required to apply for asylum in a so-called safe third country, what the U.S. considers Mexico. And since Pastor had done that and been rejected, then he was able to apply for asylum in the States. So his case seems to be moving along really well. The happiest surprise of all is that the first person to have contacted me about a month ago now, or maybe more, was the person who had been doing the slowest journey, and that was George.
Really?
Who had been so injured, and nobody really expected him to make it out of the Darien Gap. He spent 2 weeks alone making it out of the Darien, literally crawling. And he made it out faster than any of the rest of his group out of the U.S. detention system. And he's also in Maryland. Very grateful that this journey is over. There's still, I have not heard from Benita, for example, who is a woman who I followed through the story. She had been in detention in Mexico, and I have not heard from her since late November, and none of her friends know where she was. We know that she did make it to the U.S. border, and so we're assuming that she did cross over, and I'm guessing that she's probably in detention still. And of the four Pakistanis, three are out of the detention system now. They're kind of all spread across the U.S., but one of them is still in detention and has really come across a real glitch in his case, which will probably sound very familiar to anybody who follows Colombia, in terms of, how one is determined a collaborator or taking sides within a conflict. So he had disclosed to American authorities that, the Taliban once came to his family's door in Pakistan, and they had to give the Taliban food. The Taliban were armed, of course, and the family really had no choice. But from what I understand of his case now, this Pakistani is being questioned for having collaborated with the Taliban, for having shared food with them, which is, a very familiar tale in Colombia, when it's so hard for civilians to remain neutral when they live alongside armed fighters who, either belong to legal or illegal forces, are cornered into situations in which they really have no choice, but then they're seen as collaborators with that force. So hearing about his situation kind of, hit home in terms of just seeing those dynamics play out over again, and spilling out across.
Well, we have to end it there for this week, but we'll be back next week with the segment three, the part three of this three-part series about crossing the Darien jungle, the Darien Gap from Colombia into Panama, and stories and tales, horrific tales, and some uplifting tales, as you remember about George, of those who don't actually make it to their final destination there in the United States. And I have to thank Nadia Drost for her time and efforts and willingness to speak to us and to go into in-depth reflections about her, this quite arduous journey. I can't do it. I wouldn't do it. So it's left to those more intrepid than I to go out there and do this and report on the stories that need reporting. And I'm just relaying information to you guys. This has been Richard McColl talking to you guys, Columbia Calling, with Nadia Drost, the journalist, Canadian journalist up there in Toronto. Thank you again, all of you, for listening. This week, in the last 30 days, we've broken 11,000 unique downloads in the last 30 days in the US alone. So that's a new record for us on the Columbia Calling podcast. Of course, the reasons behind this, you've all got more time to listen to podcasts, I think. But I would like to believe that we've also improved our quality and of indeed the type of show that we're putting out there. So thank you again. I've been Richard McColl. This has been Columbia Calling. And, you know, be sure to chain into part 3 next week. Bye-bye.